Welcome, everyone, to episode number 85 of Underserved. Today with me in studio is Ben Hodson, Principal Database Architect at Sonos. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Ben, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Hey, thank you very much, Andrew. It's great to see you again.
It's been way too long.
It certainly has.
So way back when, 1970s, you go to Dartmouth College to visit your step-grandfather. How does he introduce you to computers?
So my step-grandfather was a really, really, really interesting guy who I was extremely lucky to know. He had been an inventor since I don't know when. The stories of the things that he'd done, he knew the Wright brothers, he conversed with Amelia Earhart, he, you know, had done all these crazy things. He worked for Ford, he was the inventor of, or the designer, I should say, of the Ford Falcon. So he'd done all this stuff. And then he'd gone and become a professor at Dartmouth in their engineering school, the Thayer School. And I used to, when I would go up and visit them, he would go do work and he would drop me at his mainframe computer, which is the old teletype, and I would play baseball. Now, how do you play baseball on a teletype? It was all text-based, right? So literally, it would say, this is who's on the mound. It was all statistically driven by the two teams that were playing. You would basically say, throw pitch, bloop, hit enter. And then it would be like, it was a strike. Bleep, you push it again. And I would end up with reams of paper that I would take home as if I was going to reread the game that I just played, which I never did. But I ended up with reams of paper at home that I could then, you know, draw on the other side. I mean, I was probably 8 or 9 years old, I would say, at the times that that happened. But having him in my life was really amazing because he was a natural teacher as well. So he had an amazing workshop in his basement, metal lathe, bandsaws, wood stuff. He had stock of metal and styrofoam and everything you could possibly imagine. I remember he used to have a ham radio that he would dial in for the correct time. And I have no idea where that was coming from at the time, but it used to be like just a constant ham signal of the time with a tone. And he used to buy quartz clocks and like he would have a bunch of them in the basement and he would set them all and then try to figure out which was the most perfectly aligned clock.
Who's drifting on me?
Exactly. And then he would take them apart and try to improve them at the same time, right? So they had a little brook that ran through their side yard and it would come alive in the spring with the snow melt. And I used to love to go up there and play in the brook. And one day he was like, hey, why don't we make a boat float down the brook? And I'm like, okay. So we go down the basement and we grab some styrofoam and like we shape it like on the bandsaw. We take it out, we put it in the river, things spinning and tumbling in the river. And he's like, how do you think we fix that? So now we add some weights on the bottom and we go back out. And okay, now it sits flat, but still spinning. Okay, how do we fix that? And then we go back in. And never guiding me, never saying like, you know, oh, do this next, do that next. But what are we going to try next? What do you think would help? As a really young kid, it like stuck with me, this whole try and try again. Like, how do you go through that process? The other thing I remember him doing was when Three Mile Island happened, petrified of, you know, nuclear power, radiation, things like that. And we happened to go up there, I think the week that that happened. And he says to me, oh, you know, your stepdad told me, you know, you're a little panicky about radiation, right? And I was like, yeah, it seems a little scary. And he's like, it's not scary. It's everywhere. I'm like, well, wait, that's scary. And he's like, no, it's fine. It's in nature. Like, and of course, he like takes a Geiger counter that he happened to have in the basement in his workshop. And he brings it upstairs and he like walks up to the fireplace and he just kind of waves it around. Then he waves it over the bricks in the fireplace. And he's like, totally natural. He's like, come on, we'll go outside. And he walks up to like the stone wall. And it's radiation, not killer radiation, not so much that you don't normally absorb it, but that it's natural. It's everywhere. I don't know if that successfully kept me to not be afraid of radiation. But at the same time, it made you think that, okay, it's natural. And basically, it's something that if you have too much of is a problem, which is the same with so many other things.
Sugar, alcohol.
Exactly. Speed. So there's all of that. And I think that that really turned me. And that whole side of the family was very engineering focused, My stepbrother went on to start several medical engineering companies that have done various things. And it's been really, really interesting, that whole mindset of here's a problem, iterate to solve it. And I think I took that and rolled with it through my entire life.
I think you made a career out of it.
Pretty much, yeah. And not just a career, but like a mindset of how I approach any problem, right? Like, hey, I'm not going to get it right the first time, but I'm going to get it partially right the first time and then improve it as I go.
A lot of folks in an engineering background go more of like the test-taking route. Like, if I don't get it right, then it's wrong and it's terrible and I did bad. And no, like, you got to give yourself permission to fail once in a while in order to get there.
As long as you learn from your failure, failure is awesome. It can be so powerful. And one of the things is like, you know, perfect is the enemy of done, right? I totally agree with that. But damn it, I'm going to try to get it as perfect as I can before I push it out the door, because we all know if I still see flaws with it as I'm pushing it out the door that I know are going to bite me and like the straight on flows, I'm going to be back at it next week. If it's the edge cases of edge cases that are going to cause me problem, ship it. Like, we'll figure those out later. So I think that basically scientific principle of experiment, test, just continue on with that. Like, no real academic experience with computers, with technology. I went to school for television and film, BA from a state school, did a lot of that. But what I realized was that I learned a lot about flow. So video, audio, all the stuff you're doing here. You have your ins, your outs, you have all your different pieces of hardware. You have to connect them in certain ways to get certain things. You can connect them in other ways to get other things to happen. Kind of sounds like systems engineering a little bit, right? So you build up that mindset. And that was kind of what I did, was just figure out how to put stuff together to get it to work the way I wanted it to, without necessarily understanding like how that individual piece works internally. Because like, I don't know, it's a tool. I'm just going to use it and I'm going to hook it up to this other tool and I'm going to get this output that I want. The last thing we did in our the college prep for going into television was you did a full-term internship somewhere. So I did a full-term internship for a house in Kenmore Square, Boston post-production. Had probably one of my most embarrassing events ever in my life happen there. So this was a small studio. We shot a lot of commercials there, a lot of industrial films, stuff like that. They had two or three edit suites and they had a good-sized studio. And I think I'd been there maybe a month. And there was the first big shoot that was going on. They were doing a Stop and Shop commercial. I was on something else, but they had the whole studio all decked out. The client was there. The owner of the Boston Post was there to smooze and stuff. And one of the guys that I'm working with goes, oh, go in and grab me that C-stand out of the corner and just bring it out. We need it for the other thing. I'm like, okay, no problem. So I walk in and I grab the stand and I'm walking out and I catch my toe on something. And I kind of stumble. It happened to be a cord that went up to this 21-inch monitor that was standing on a pillar. And it just tipped ever so slightly and face-planted on the floor, shattering and exploding. And there I am, like, holding the C-stand, like, right next to it. And, like, everybody turns to look at me. And I'm just like, oh, God.
Dude, back then, that was like a month's salary.
Oh, easy, easy. And the guy who runs the studio is like, well, that was good. And he goes, but you did just show us all that we should be gaffer taping down all the cords in the studio.
And that was like roadway things that they put over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, that was a great way to start my internship. Everybody knew my name after that. It was perfect.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Then you got some trial by fire helping your dad in his business, right?
My dad had this electrical supply company. It had been started by my grandfather. I'd worked there my whole life. One of the things about that was it was a very manual process. So I'd learned a ton about electrical, right? I still now will do most of my own electrical. I'm a little sketchy on actually opening up the panel and playing with that because it's where bad things happen. But otherwise, I'll mess around with any of it. But he was spending his whole life pricing things. So back in the day, there was no bar scanners. There was no self-checkout, right? Basically, it was a repeat customer business. Your contractors came in. They gave you a big list of stock. You ran around in the back of the store. You pulled all that stock together. You gave it to them. They signed a slip that you wrote up with all the stock that they took. They left. They didn't pay for anything. My dad then got that slip. He had to price it, right? The contractors would leave having no idea what they just spent. And they would get a bill at the end of the month that would say, you know, here's what you owe. They would pay that. And it gave them a line of credit. And I've still talked to some contractors who I knew back then who were like, your dad was the reason I got into the business because he offered me a line of credit when nobody else would. And it allowed me to do my first few jobs and get paid before I had to pay for the supplies. And that was the way I think the business still works today for most of the small or even larger supply houses that are out there. But he was stuck doing all this manual work, doing all this manual pricing. And he would sit at this giant book that they called the trade service. And every vendor that you sold sent you a section of their book. And you got weekly updates where you had to flip through it and pull out the old pages and put in the new pages as the pricing changed, right? So it was like this constant book that you updated. And he would sit there on weekends. He would sit there in the morning, in the afternoon, if he wasn't out at the counter waiting on customers. He would just sit there with these slips that had just gone out the door, pricing them, coming up with the totals, flipping through this book. And it got to the point where like he'd know the prices of like half the stuff in the book because everybody was ordering the same things, but not all of it. Like there's a lot of specialty stuff that he would always have to look up. So I was like, there's got to be a better way to do this, right? Like there's automated stuff. There's computer systems. We've seen this stuff. So he got involved with a local company who wrote him some custom stuff that worked pretty well, but it was really inflexible. So I then went and looked trade service, partnered up with a company and come out with software. So I went down to Bluebell, Pennsylvania, took training on it. We did a demo with them. We found out, you know, we compared them to, I think it was like Great Plains at the time was another one. And the big difference between the demo was Great Plains came in and showed us, I don't know, I think it was furniture that they were selling with their app. And Trade Service came in and showed us electrical equipment. And it made a million times like more sense looking at stuff you knew rather than made up stuff. So that was another thing I learned as I was going through that process.
Give good demo.
Give demo of what the customer wants, not something abstract that sort of relates to what they want. So we move forward with that. I installed that system. And one of the things it did was it taught me the business at a level that I didn't know before from the financial side. Because you had to set your markups, you had to set your costs, you had to set up accounts payable, you had to set up accounts receivable, you had to set up inventory. You basically had to set up the entire company in this computer. Customer discount. Who is your best customer? Who's your best payer? Who's your worst? How much do you mark it up? What type of quantity breaks do you give? Like it was a full boat, full stack set of stuff that we went through there. And that really got me kind of tied into computers. And I ended up working on a PC when I was running the office, using Excel to do payroll, keep track of, you know, accounts receivable and accounts payable just outside the main system. So that really got me kind of moving forward. And I would say that my dad was anti-technology. And at the time, I feel a little guilty because I had him sit at the computer and he's like, oh, this is great. You know, it's like, and he looked over at the mouse and he was like, what does this do? And I'm like, oh, that's the microphone. You talk to the computer. And he like picked it up and he's like, computer, can you tell me? And I felt so bad.
Oh man, you punk dad.
Yeah. And he laughed about it, but still I felt a little bad for that. When I finished up that, you know, I really got exposed to that PC, America Online, CompuServe, like all the online services were just starting out at that point and doing a lot of like graphic stuff, you know, still kind of clinging to the old, you know, art stuff that I was doing in college. But then I started to get into drag racing. I started to get into cars a lot. I always had been really interested in cars, you know, never bought a new car, always had an old car, did my own brakes, water pump, played around with all that stuff, rebuilt carburetors. Again, more mechanical engineering. And then as I went into, oh, wait, I'm making some decent money working for my dad and ended up with a car that was called the Firehawk. It was a 94 Firehawk. There were very limited numbers of them. I think they made 500 a year or something like that. But the platform that it was built on had a 6-speed transmission, and the six gear was like such a radical overdrive that like it was a waste. Like it would be like you'd be going like 80 at like, I don't know, 2200 RPM, right? Which is great for mileage. But we got thinking like, well, wait, we can change the rear gear ratio of this car. And just like they used to do, you'd hear people talk about 410 gears, 373 gears, things like that in the car. And the car that we added 342 gears in it at the time. And I needed to know, well, what gear should I put into it? So I started thinking about this. And there's, you know, all the math. You have to figure out, well, what's the ratio from the transmission? And what are all the gear ratios for each gear in the transmission? And then that translates back to the rear gear. And then you multiply them and you get the revolutions of the tire related to the revolutions of the engine. So I'm not going to do that all on paper, right? So I had a friend and he was doing some VB work and he had said like, hey, you know, we're starting to do coding with VB. And I said, oh, what's VB? He's like, oh, it's Visual Basic. It's like basic, but visual, right? And just meaning you could do a much better graphical interface much easier than you could. Well, then there was none really in basic, right? It was all command line. So wrote myself a program that I could put in what are all the gears? What are the gears in the gearbox? What are their ratios? What's the gear in the rear end? What's the speed that I would be going at if I'm at this RPM? And knowing that I'd been to the racetrack before, running quarter miles, knowing what my trap speeds were, I could kind of figure out like, well, I always knew I was well into third gear by the time I got through the trap. So what would get me to the top of third gear without having to shift into fourth gear, right? Because you don't want another gear shift because that's going to cost you time. What RPM is the top of third gear that gets me to a speed, gets me to what rear gear ratio? And we found 373 gears would put me just at the top of third gear at that time. Now, of course, it doesn't take into account wind resistance, you know, like any of that stuff, but close enough. Put 373 gears in the car was game changer, like as far as the acceleration the car had. And you still dropped it into sixth gear. Instead of 2200, it was 2400. Like, okay, so who cares? It's a much, much faster car. And that was the first thing that I wrote. And writing that, what I found and what still is true today, like I don't use technology unless I have a purpose to use it. And theoretical use of technology, like I can't deal with it. I'll go to a training for something I know I'm not going to use for 3 months. 3 months later, like the amount of stuff I've retained from that is never very much. I think in terms of concepts and process. So if I can pick something up and use it right away, if I've used it three times, it's now ingrained. I'm gonna know that concept. I'm going to understand that pattern and use it over and over again. If I pick it up once, doesn't usually stick so well.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first, you must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So what leads you to the Computer Learning Center?
So this was, God, when was this? This was early 90s, and this was the advent of the big box store. So we had Home Depot, Home Quarters come in. And what we quickly realized was they were selling electrical products for less than we could buy them for. Being able to sell something for more than what you bought it for is kind of what you want to be doing, right? You know, so we talked to our vendors and they were like, well, can you buy, you know, a shipload of outlets? And we were like, no. And it's like, well, then this is going to be your price. So what we found was all the commodities we stopped selling. So we couldn't sell like a box of outlets, a box of old work boxes, like all the bread and butter stuff that people bought in large quantity that you didn't make a ton of money on, but you made something on. But what they would come to you for was all the specialty equipment that they couldn't get at the box stores, but that's not enough to run a business, right? So you'd get 10 orders from this customer rather than the 40 orders you got last month, right? So it got to the point where I was writing out the checks to our vendors and like taping them to the calendar on the day I thought I would be able to send them. We just slowly drained. So my dad said to me, you know, at one point, he's like, I think you may want to find something else to do. And again, I had that buddy and he was like, yeah, you know, look, dude, learn Visual Basic. Like, I'll hire you. No problem. Like, we need people over here. They were doing assessing software for real estate, selling it to municipalities. They'd been on an old Mumps platform, and they were porting it all over to Visual Basic. So I was like, all right, you know, I had a book, and I'd done some work with it, but I kind of felt like I needed some real training in it. I couldn't figure out how to print, like stupid things like that. I was like, I should probably just go and really, you know, it didn't matter how much I looked through the book. I found stuff on printing, but I could never really get it to work. So I found this place in Somerville. It was called the Computing Learning Center. They did night school, and they had a class that covered Visual Basic, Access, a little bit of C, and some Unix, and started out with Visual Basic. So I was like, oh, great, I'll go to school. Perfect, right? So I like took out a small loan and I went back to school and did that. I was working for my dad then. I was working at a convenience store down the street nights after I was finishing up with my dad. I was living in southern New Hampshire. This store was down in Massachusetts in Reading. So I was like constantly driving back and forth. I was drag racing at the same time. I went down, I started going to school there nights. So then my days were just like, you know, 7 a.m, go to work for my dad, go to the convenience store or go to school, come home, you know, rinse and repeat. So I get there to the Computing Learning Center and I thought like, all right, this is going to be great. I'm going to learn so much. And I went and took the entrance exam. And when I was going to start there, and they have just a general IQ test that they give you, I don't know if they're like filtering people out because they don't want them to be unhappy if they don't think that they can learn, you know, their curriculum. And kind of as a joke, I said like, oh, what's the highest score you've ever had on this thing? And they're like, oh, like not like a 97. And I was like, but he's like, but don't worry, that was some crazy Russian guy. Like we've had nothing close to that. Like don't even think about it. And I was like, yeah, no problem. So I took the test and it was all pattern matching, just a general IQ test and tons of pattern matching in it. And that's what I thrive on. That's what my brain like lives for, I found later on. And so I did it as best I could. And there were a couple questions that were just like, there is no pattern here. Like, I don't get this. And I'm like, all right, well, whatever, I'll guess. And
C.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, so I bring it out and I give it to him and I'm sitting there and like, he gets out his little answer key because it's one of those, you know, fill in the bubble things. And he lays it over the top and he jumps up in his cube, and we were in this cube farm where they were doing all the recruiting to get people into the school. And he just yells out, "We got somebody who beat the Russian." And I'm like, oh, man, okay, I did good. Awesome, right? And then I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, oh, that's great. I got the highest score ever. And then I'm like, oh, wait, I got the highest score ever. Like, huh, who are the other people I'm going to be going to school with? Like, all right, well, we'll see how this goes. What was really funny was I couldn't let it go. So like, he's like, yeah, you got these two wrong. I'm like, okay, can we look at those two? Like, cause I cannot, like, help me out here. What do you see what's the right answer? And he's like, oh, it's this one. And I'm like, oh, do you see why that matches these other things? And he's like, nope, doesn't make any sense to me either. And I'm like, all right, I feel a little better. But yeah, I went there. I sat in the courses. They helped me because I focused. Like, you know, I really had to spend the time. You had homework, you had tests, you had to write applications for them. But it wasn't earth-shattering. Like, I never really felt challenged. Like, it got to the point where, like, I was teaching the teachers. First day, I asked, like, how do I print? The guy's like, oh, in Visual Basic? I'm like, yeah, that's what we're doing, right? How do I print? And he's like, oh, it's printer.print, and then put your message in the params afterwards. And I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like, all right, great. So that was the one thing that stuck in my head that I couldn't figure out. And God knows why. Like, I swear to God, I tried that. Like, I swear to God, I tried everything and it didn't work. But, you know, I came out of there. I quit before we got to Unix. I gave up on it and said, like, ugh, if it's Unix, I really don't want to use it. I was really a Windows, you know, very GUI. I'm very visual learner. So, like, the idea of just everything being command line was just like, oh, God. So my buddy was ready to hire me. I had the job before I even finished school. I left my dad's company and I went to work for them. And I was doing their setup program. They needed an install program for their application to put on all the PCs in the town hall. At first, I was like, oh, this is going to be easy, right? And then, like, all the different configurations and setting up all the config files and setting, like, making sure everything got to the right place. It was like, whoa, okay, there's a lot to this. But, you know, within a month or so, had that all pretty well ironed out and everybody was pretty happy with it. And what happened was attrition within a year and a half, 2 years, everybody else had left from the technology side. They'd moved on to other things. And I found myself heading up the technology group. And we had maybe 3, 4, 5 developers there at the time. One of them was somebody you and I worked very close with, Brian Pierce. He became and still is one of the greatest SQL Server DBAs I've ever known.
But where did you find him?
So Brian came from Babbage's, which was the forerunner to Electronics Boutique back in the day. And my friend Scott, who's the one who got me the job, we used to go, you know, drop in there and look to see what the new games were on lunch and stuff like that down the street. And he was kind of working there. And he was like, you guys are in here all the time and you're buying all this stuff. And like, what do you do? And we're like, oh, we're coders. We work up the street, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, we do Visual Basic and we're using SQL Server and Access. And he's like, well, how do I get in on that? And we're like, go back to night school, go take some classes. You know, if you can figure out X, Y, and Z, come, you know, talk to us and we'll bring you in for an interview. 6 months go by. He's like, dude, I'm ready. I've been going to school. I'm good to do this. Brought him in, did excellent on his test, started with doing crystal reports. So he was writing all our reports for us. So he got really close with the database and writing all that stuff. But he had an affinity for SQL Server, for the hardware, for stuff like that. And after Scott had left and I was heading everything up, I came in one day. And again, I was driving down from New Hampshire still. This company was out in Peabody. So I would always drive down early to avoid the traffic. And I come into the office and usually I'm the first one there. And I thought I was the first one there. And I sit down in my office and turn on everything and like can't log in. Like there's nothing there. I'm like, what the hell? And I go next door into the server room and the door had been shut and I open up the door and there's the server laid out on the floor in like, I don't know, 30, 40 different pieces, all the drives pulled out, all the boards pulled out. And there's Brian sitting on the floor next to it. Like, and he looks up, oh, dude, you're here. And I'm like, yeah, I was trying to log in. He's like, give me like 20 minutes and I'll have this back together. Like, I read this article last night about that. We should get so much better performance once I do this. And I was like, okay. And I went back to my desk and sure enough, half hour later, like the thing was running like a champ. Like we were getting more performance out of it than we ever had before. And that, you know, like myself, experiment, try stuff, repeat. And Brian just took to that with the DBA work that he did. And he just knew SQL Server in any way. He was writing to Microsoft. He was like telling them where they had screwed up stuff. Like every time I worked with him, right? And I worked with him several different times. He was always in that mode. And I swear, if you go to Microsoft, they must have a file on him somewhere.
Well, you made another super solid hire in Mike Bro. How'd that happen?
Mike Bro. He came in on an interview. We were looking for more developers at the time. And I'd had a bad experience right before that where I hired a guy out of some tech school. And they came in and they just didn't get it. Like, I basically gave him the same thing I'd gotten. We needed to update our setup program. And I gave him that to work on. And he just couldn't do it. He had been through the classes. He knew all the syntax. He just didn't know what it did. Like, he didn't know how to put it together. And I was like, ugh. So we had to let him go. And he actually let himself go. He was both kind of like, oh, dude, this is not working. And I'm like, no, it's not. And so we put out this thing. And when Mike came in, I kind of devised this test. And it was really like to get rid of dupes. You have a whole bunch of data in an Access database, and some of it's duplicated. How do you get rid of those records that are exactly the same? How do you know which one to get rid of and which one to keep and things like that? So he was the first one I gave this thing to, and I just kind of whipped it up and handed it to him and did great on his interview otherwise. And he came back like a couple days later and he was like, dude, like, yeah, I want to give you the solution for this, but I can't figure this out. I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, no, like, he's like, honestly, he's like, I asked my professor at school. I talked to other people about it. I've spent probably like 30 hours on this thing. And I was just like, ooh, that wasn't the intent here. I'm like, well, let's look at it again. And so we start looking at it and I'm like, oh, yeah, this is unsolvable. Like, there's no way you can answer this question. And I'm like, so you're hired. And yeah, that's unsolvable. You're right.
I would argue that the same thing happened to him that happened to you on that IQ test.
Yeah. Exactly.
This isn't right.
Do I really want to work for these people who can't even give me a question I can answer? But the fact that he put so much effort into it only goes to prove how tenacious Mike is. And I think if anybody who knows Mike knows, tenacious is more than his middle name.
Everything I've ever seen him tackle from a technical perspective, just absolute wizard level mastery because he throws so much at it.
Yeah. Like sleep, it becomes the secondary concern. Eating becomes a secondary concern until he's got something figured out. I'm at Patriot. Patriot Properties is the name of the company that I was at the time. And they're still around today doing assessing for real estate in municipalities. And it was a small shop, right? I mean, I think at the heyday I was there, we might have had six developers total. you know, one of the great things about that company was going out and doing sales calls. And as a young guy at the time, myself and my boss would go and do these sales calls. And we would go to Sarasota, Florida. We would go to Tampa. We would go like all over the country and pitch our product. We went to Hawaii. That was a great pitch. I went to Point Barrow, Alaska, northern coast of Alaska, about as far north as you can go in Alaska for an install after we'd gotten a client up there, because none of the other people in the team wanted to go do it. I'm like, are you all crazy? You don't want to go there? Like, this is insane. Like, I'm totally going. But traveling with him and doing those calls, the beauty of it was I was the lead developer. I had the source code on my laptop when we were traveling. We would go and we would do a pitch and we would walk in and we would typically do 2-day pitches. The first day we would walk through, you know, how you'd enter all the data, how we do valuations. And Ellis, who is my boss, was like, he knew all of the real estate side inside and out. And I knew all the code inside and out. I didn't necessarily know why I was calculating certain things, but we would calculate it the right way. So we would go in and we would do our pitch. And inevitably, somewhere in that first day, someone would ask for some field or something that they wanted to collect that we didn't necessarily have in the product. And I would kind of glance over at Ellis. And he would either nod or shake his head when I did that. And we would go home, like back to the hotel after that. And I would code it right then. I would add whatever that field was if he'd nodded when that came through. And we would go in the next day and we would start off our presentation for the second day. And he would go, oh, wait, yeah, that thing you asked for yesterday, that new field. Oh, yeah, here. He'd bring up the code. He'd bring up the application. Oh, yeah, we added it last night for you. And like, you could hear a pin drop every time we did that. They're like, well, what? No way. Like, it's like, yeah, and that's going to roll out to all of our customers in the next couple months. And we got, I think we were like 95% of everything we pitched, we got. Everybody else would come in and do their sales call and they would ask them things like that. And they would go like, we'll get back to you. We're going to talk to our developers about that. And if you've been the developer on the other side of those sales calls, you know that like the guy comes back and goes like, we need these four fields like now so we can get this contract. And you're like, but those suck. Like, why would we put those in there, right? Why do you mean you promised those, right?
It's going to take 3 months minimum.
Exactly. So we had the ability of Ellis saying like, that's garbage, don't put it in, or ooh, that's kind of valuable, we should put that in on the front. And with me there to actually do it right there, could just push those sales right through. And the other great thing about traveling with him was, if he thought the demo went well, which was most of the time, he would say, so if you could go to dinner anywhere in town tonight, like, where would you go? And these are the people who are going around and doing all the property assessments in the city or town, so they know every place, right? And we went to some amazing restaurants on the company dime coming out of those things. So I started looking for something else to do. I really wanted to focus on SQL Server, or at least on databases. Ran across a job for this company called Essential.com. They were looking for a database person, and I was like, oh, cool. I'll go give that a try. What the hell? Threw away all the VB stuff, all the other development stuff I'd learned, and just focused on databases when I went there. And it was trial by fire, which I love. Thrown in the deep end, a couple of good mentors there who like help guide me through like, well, how am I supposed to do this? Oh, you should use this. You should use that. This is when I learned about the infamous thing of a temp table, which I had never used before, but like light bulbs went off when like I went through this process. So up until this point, everything had been process oriented of if, then, next, loops. Everything we did, the way we valued all of the properties that we had in our system was pick up a property, value one, value two, value three, value four, spits out a final bump. Pick up property two, go through and do that same routine over and over and over.
The old Gatling gun.
The old Gatling gun. You got it. And every time we did that, like it took a long time to do all the properties in a municipality. And we did have a competitor who was like, oh, we can do a whole municipality in like 20 minutes. And we were like, no way. Like, they can't be doing that. Like, there's just, you can't even loop through all the properties in that amount of time. So I suddenly am exposed to, you know, straight database work. And I'm like, holy crap, there's a temp table. And then you process everything as sets. You don't do it as individual pieces. And like, oh, we've been using our database all wrong. That was so freeing. And what I realized was that that's really the way I was thinking anyway. I just had no way to implement it in anything that I was doing. So I took to it kind of like a fish to water and was like, whoa, okay, like I can do all this stuff now. So I actually went back to the old company, back to Patriot, and like taught a 2-hour class of like, this is how you should rewrite the whole calculation thing. You should do it all at once, all in temp tables. Each step, you're actually valuing all the properties at once. And they were competing with Vision, like, you know, within a month after that, as far as being able to calculate a municipality. That was great.
Essential's business model was kind of funny. And perhaps not sustainable. Would you care to comment on that?
So Essential's goal was to pay all of your utilities through them. So you would give them all of the information about all of your utilities. They would make deals with all of these utility companies so that you would get their bill electronically through them, pay it electronically through your credit card, and you didn't have to send out checks anymore. We all know how that ended up. We're all doing that today, like, very easily. But back then, this was novel. Like, everybody was writing checks to everybody or going down and physically dropping off money to people. The key to their business was QWest, which was long distance. And this was during the long distance wars of, like, ooh, who can get long distance pricing lowest? And how do I get this, you know, super cheap so I can call my relative in California and things like that? Does long distance cost us anything anymore? I don't even notice.
If you ask my kids what's long distance, right, they look at you funny.
Exactly. We just text anyway. So they would try to get you to switch to QWest because they would get a kickback from QWest for new customers. They had this whole payment process with QWest already baked in. So you could just give them a credit card and they would automatically pay your phone bill for you, right? And the way that this whole game worked for all of these long distance companies was your phone service can be switched by you cashing a check. So you send them the check for $100 and you say, hey, if you cash this check, we'll switch you to QWest and you can go do all this stuff. So when you cash the check, that gives us, we say, ooh, they cashed the check. They go to the phone service, to the phone company, and they say, oh, we're switching this person from this long distance to this long distance. And they have that agreement and they go ahead and they do it. Thing that happens is you can call the phone service yourself and say, like, hey, I'm on MCI. Nobody can switch that without my approval. And they go, okay, yes, sir. And they mark that down. You go cash the check. We go try to switch you over. And it says, nope, sorry, that functionality has been blocked. Okay, now what?
Can't, like, sue them over $100.
How many people are you going to chase for $100? Everybody was cashing their check and then we would never convert anybody. So at one point, probably towards the end of it, I had been tasked with changing the whole billing system. So we had to, like, pick all of the billing system up out of one system, convert it. I think it was a merge between, like, a couple different platforms into one platform for all of our billing. And I worked on it for a good solid 3 weeks, right? And tested it six ways to Sunday. This was like bread and butter. I couldn't screw up anybody's customer information or billing information or anything like that. Put in a ton of cleansing checks. Spent all this time making this conversion. We implemented it. We released it. My boss comes in like the morning after. Dude, like, I don't know what's happening. Like, I just heard from them that they were only able to bill 60% of our customers after the conversion. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, they could only bill 60% of the customers. So I go back and I start digging through my code and I'm like racking my brain and I'm running all my test cases again and they're all coming back. Like, everything's the same, source and destination. I'm like, I don't get it. And then about 10 minutes later, my boss comes back and, oh, dude, don't worry about it. It's fine. I'm like, what do you mean it's fine? And he's like, well, it turns out they could only bill like 40% of the customers before the conversion. I'm like, oh, what? And he's like, yeah, it's all good.
So after the conversion, you're billing 60%. So 40% of the customers are cashing $100 checks and you're never making a dime from them.
Not only are we never making a dime from them, some of them had just given us incorrect billing information. So they were also getting free long distance during this time.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is what the dot-coms were like.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so that was a pretty short stint. One little nugget I took away was we were working on a really late night implementation, a deployment for the website and everything. And we just couldn't get it to roll out. It's like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning and just butting our heads against the wall with like, why won't this work right? We did everything right. We QA'd it. And my boss at the time was just like, okay, rolling it back. And we were like, no, we can fix this. We can fix this. He's like, nope, roll it back. I'm like, but we can. He's like, stop. He's like, there will always be more work in the morning. No matter what you do, there will always be more work. So we're going to roll this back. You're going to come in the morning. And within 10 minutes, you will have figured out what this problem was. You will not be able to figure it out now.
In 10 hours.
No, in 10 hours, I wouldn't be able to figure out what it is now. And I still... It's now not like 2 in the morning when that happens to me. It may be early evening when my mind is just like so overwhelmed with what I've done during the day. But it, same thing holds true. I'll think about it. I'll dream about it. I'll wake up the next morning and it's like, sir, how did I not see this? And move forward with that. But that whole concept of there's always more work is really interesting in technology. As there's very limited big wins as you move through the technology stack in most of the jobs that we hold within this, right? You do a release, but before that release has even gotten out, you're already working on the next release, right? You haven't even really celebrated that release. So us celebrating the good things that we've done is often overlooked. We know, right? I mean, the main reason I'm in technology, the main reason I'm in development is I'm a problem solver. I love solving puzzles, solving problems, right? So I know I've solved that problem, but there's always another problem right behind it and another one behind that, right? So you're constantly chasing those problems. So it's really hard to find satisfaction beyond you've solved the problem, right? And if you can live with that, it's very easy to love this industry, right? And just, hey, there's another problem. Yep, I'm going to get that one. Yep, I'm going to get that one. What I see a lot of is a lot of people in technology now are very career oriented. It's like, okay, I'm going to go in and I'm going to do this. Then I'm going to be promoted to this. Then I'm going to be promoted to this. Then I'm going to be promoted to this. And that's where I want to be. And oftentimes they don't even know where they want to be, like what that role really entails, or is that something they really want to do? They just have this impression of that as the natural progression. I don't think I've ever really been like that. I've kind of had aspirations, but at the same time, I'm usually two heads down and enjoying the problems in front of me too much to really think about like, well, how am I going to map that out? Is that a conscious thing that I'm going to do? When I left Essential, because of obvious reasons, right? I left there and again, Brian Pierce, who we talked about earlier, he came and worked with me at Essential. He had gone to a finance company in Boston when he left Patriot. He worked there for a bunch of years. He kind of got bored there. I said, oh, come to Essential. Stuff's crazy here. We had basically put a whole bunch of front-end servers for the website. And then we replicated from those front-end servers down to a back-end server so we could do reads from those and writes from the other, just scaling stuff at that time. And that was really kind of interesting at the time we were doing it. So he came and worked there. We both left Essential at the same time. We were both like, oh God, this is going nowhere fast. He ended up at Monster. I left there and went to a small, another dot bomb that was doing day trading and was trying to figure out how to write day trading applications. Interesting crossover there. I wrote my first Spam-O-Matic. I think everybody in technology at one point has written something to auto-mail people stuff, especially if you came up through the 90s and early 2000s. That was the game, was how do I take a mailing list and actually have it send emails out?
Oh, the good old SMTP communicator.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And how do I hook that to an Access database and a mail form and integrate them and things? That was actually the only thing I did when I worked for this company, because I was only there for about 3 weeks before they lost second round funding. And I was kind of like, and they came to me and said, are you willing to take a 50% pay cut? And I was like, I've kind of only been here like 2 or 3 weeks. I don't have that much invested here. I think I'm going to move on. But the emailer that I wrote was actually for the Motley Fool, who no one knew who he was at the time. I didn't know who he was at the time. He was a partner with these people who were doing this day trading thing, and they kind of did this emailing for him on the side. So I found that really interesting later on when like, whoa, like this guy's become big. Like that's pretty crazy. I don't think he's using the same code I wrote for him back then.
No, not with all the checks that they do now before they let emails go anywhere.
Yeah.
Because of spammers like you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Folks, Ben and I had not caught up in several years. When he came into the studio to record, we talked for over 2 hours. So much so that we created both this regular episode as well as a bonus episode. The bonus episode is called Modern History. You can find it on our website, underserved.fm, as well as on Apple Podcasts and Google Play. Download Modern History now to continue the conversation. Until then.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved Podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.